Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
On the last episode of Guilt.
She said, I remember when we went into the city on the train and I thought, oh my God, this train ride goes forever. And she said, when we stopped it, she said it was a train station and the line is, oh, you don't want to get off here. Like, oh, I don't get off here anymore.
Are there at this point in time any other reasonable, I use the word reasonable, lines of investigation you think should be pursued?
No.
The family of a Melton teenager who died 6 years ago are for the first time appealing for further information about the girl's death before the release of a coroner's finding later this month.
But she was just so happy, so bubbly, smiling all the time. Like, she was just so much fun to be around. She was just beautiful.
If I could go back now knowing what I know now, they'd be dead. Yeah, I'd be in jail.
And she got stolen away from me. And those culprits who did it, I want to catch them. I want to get them. And they know who they are. And I won't ever give up.
From Brevity Studios, I'm Ryan Wolfe. And this is Guilt. Good morning. It is day two of the investigation in Melbourne. I'm on my way to Melton this morning to meet a former Victorian police officer who has been helping Peter out with the case over the last 12 months or so. And he grew up in Melton and still lives in Melton. So I think he might have some interesting insight in terms of the city and Alana's case. And then later on, an interview with one of Alana's childhood friends, which, you know, brings a whole nother element to it. Just reflecting on yesterday, it's just an incredibly sad and tragic case. And, you know, I saw some really raw emotion yesterday. I don't know how much of it came through on the audio. But, you know, when you're dealing with the loss of just such a young person and circumstances like this, and it seemed like she'd really turned a corner and had clearly been taken advantage of, more than taken advantage of, by older men. Yeah, it makes my blood boil. And I'm sure it will for you too. And, you know, just makes you realize in life how, you know, it's just small moments that define where we go and the paths we take. And, you know, no one's perfect, especially not when you're only, you know, 14, 15, 16. And like Peter said, he sees, you know, your peer groups that you land in is somewhat of, it's like the lottery when you're that age. And and everyone will know people that ended up in the wrong peer group, or maybe you did, and maybe you got out of it, or maybe you didn't. But there's some bad apples out there, and for, you know, their own reasons, you know, and a young person's life can just be led astray so easily. And obviously Alana's struggles had, you know, made things difficult at home, and Peter and Cheryl, you know, did break up, and that probably exacerbated the problem a little bit. And, you know, as anyone will know that's been through a breakup, when you're a young person, it affects you quite deeply. And yeah, but, you know, this part of the, you know, the investigation is really just learning a bit more about Alana and talking to her family. But tomorrow the interviews start to take a bit more of an investigative sort of angle, and I think we're going to start getting to the truth of this thing finally. And, you know, and it's time for Peter, Alana's family, it's time for them to grieve, because he said that he's never grieved in 28 years. He's just never had that chance for closure, because he's always been looking. He's always known more about the case and just never been able to rest. And in his mind, he believes Alana's not resting until this thing's resolved. So yeah, that gives me a huge amount of motivation, and I hope everyone out there listening is going to get in behind this case and Alana's story, and those that do have those pieces of information are going to come forward and stop protecting those that don't deserve to be protected. Right, okay, I've still got a 20-minute drive to get to Melton, and onwards.
Christine, yeah, yeah, they live a basic life, yeah. Mm. He's just suffered, yeah. And he was a school teacher in the area that everybody loved. He talked to these kids who are in this file. If they taught him, they loved him. Mm. And he just didn't deserve this. You know, Ricky was my good friend at school. Great guy, yeah. Didn't deserve this.
Yeah.
You know, Cheryl used to be so bubbly, I remember her. Like, fiery sort of red hair, you know, funny and laughing, and now I don't even see her. I don't even see her. She hasn't even spoken to me about this. So, yeah, if something can come, even the fact that you try just means the world to them, I'm sure, that you try when nobody else has. In that file, that Peter wrote to every politician that was around at the time. Victoria Police was kind of defending their detective in their investigation. They didn't need to do that. To me, they just need to have another try for Peter. Just come open, you know, be open about it, and just go, you know, like, you deserve for us to have another try. There were some things that was missed, and
we fucked some stuff up.
Yeah, the detective at the time was going through some stuff or whatever. Let's just have another go. Look over with fresh eyes. You know, let's just, you know, give you something just to show them that they had another try, and that Alana wasn't, like, just, you know, undeserving because she was a kid on heroin. Like, that's not the society we want.
Yeah.
To say, oh, she's not deserving of a nice investigation because she used heroin. She's 16. She was 16.
This morning, I'm meeting former Victorian police officer Kane Gabert. He's friendly and softly spoken, but carries that assured confidence of a cop. He knew Ricky and Alana, and some time ago, knowing that Peter was struggling with the case, he reached out and offered his help. Given Kane was in the police and worked in this area, I thought it would be a great opportunity to get an understanding of the drug scene from someone who likely experienced it on a day-to-day basis.
So I'm Kane Gabert. And I did grow up here in Melton. I was born here. I was family friends with the Cecils. Ricky and I went to school together. Alana was his little sister. They were sporty kids at school. Our parents used to associate with each other, you know, school drop-offs and pick-ups and that sort of thing. In secondary school, I went to a different secondary school, so lost contact with Ricky and Alana, really. And would only really see him from time to time walking, you know, the local shops and that sort of thing. I don't remember how I become aware that Alana passed away, but shortly after her death, I become aware of that. And for years, I always, you know, wondered what had happened and didn't really know. And then one day I saw a tribute page for Alana on Facebook, and I sort of joined that. And then it kind of always irritated me what I read on Peter's page, to know that, you know, something untoward had happened to Alana, and you know, and that really it had gone nowhere. No, Peter never had any answers, and you could see his frustration.
Yeah.
So one day I contacted Peter and I said, "Oh, do you mind if I have a look at things with you and see? Like, I'd like to know what happened for a start." And he sort of said, "Oh, we don't really know what happened. There's a lot." And he says, "It's been very frustrating." And he said, "Had been tormented all his life from it. So yeah, he came over one day with a box of information, and we went through it together. And
yeah. And I mean, in terms of, you know, you're just not a random person off the street, so you were part of the Victoria Police?
I was at one point, yep.
Yeah. So you worked sort of near here, was it?
Yep.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. But so you would have had a bit of an idea of the type of people in Melton and mm-hmm. with your experience in the police, and it probably gives you a bit more of an analytical view of, say, a case, in like Alana's case, and...
Mm.
I suppose that would probably help in that situation.
It does, because I understand what the drug scene was like at that time.
Yeah.
And I understand what drug users were kind of like at that time. Probably not just from Melton, but all the way up to the places where drugs were sourced. You know, St Albans, Footscray. St Albans was one of my patches from when I was a police officer. I do understand, you know, the types of people, you know, and I saw many young girls be dragged into this sort of, you know, drug culture, and, you know, and dealt with their parents as a police officer who would ring because their daughter had, you know, started using drugs or was hanging around with older men that were feeding them or at some points using them, you know.
Yeah. So in St Albans, what would be the standard MO you'd see, like, so that's a... Who's dealing drugs there, and
yep.
What's the process?
At the time, you know, there wasn't just, you know, one group of people dealing drugs. There were many, but we had quite an underworld at the time. And then we had, I know, in St Albans, with drug use and dealing, there was like an Asian culture of dealing and using heroin. And that was a really... hard group to deal with, because a lot of them didn't speak English and they had a different view on police than, you know, people if they were, you know, quite fresh migrants. They were different to other people that you're dealing with, and they were hard cookies to crack. They didn't say anything. You know, almost all interviews were no comment. And it was just you tried. But you often felt like you weren't winning.
Yeah. And so St Albans, that's how far is it? Like half an hour from here,
yep.
Roughly?
Yep.
Yeah. So it's quite common for people, young youths, to come from, say, Melton and I suppose like Sunshine, right? And they go to St Albans and get the score with their drugs and then go back. Yep. So
St Albans and Footscray had... and Sunshine a little bit, they had a higher percentage of like Asian refugees or, you know, migrants, and being that they were dealing a lot of the drugs at the time, or a portion of the drugs at the time, and weren't really living in Melton so much in large numbers, it was easier for people to get their drugs from Sunshine, St Albans and Footscray. So you would often see people catch the train in the morning, like I'd go to school as a younger person, and you'd see those people on the train actually in the morning wanting to go and score, and they'd go on the train, and then in the evening sometimes you'd see the same people come back off their head as they're coming back to Melton, and they'd spent the day using and were coming back.
Yeah.
Sort of, and they'd sit on the train sort of passing out and all that sort of thing, and then they'd get off and, yeah.
In terms of, you know, you said before about, you know, older, probably men in general, providing younger, let's just talk about younger girls in particular, with drugs, we're talking sort of under 16 years old sometimes, like?
Yeah, so as a police officer I come in contact with, like the area that I was in wasn't a poor area there at Keilor Downs when I was a police officer there, and at times there were girls that were 16 and, you know, guys that were, you know, over 18.
Yeah.
And they were hanging around with these younger girls and, kind of helping them to use drugs and sort of using them to get drugs as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I suppose, you know, something with this case and a lot of cases that involve any person that overdoses and if they have a history with drugs is that, you know, people may judge and sort of say, oh, well, you know, if you live that life, you kind of get what you deserve.
Yeah.
You know, what would your response be to that in terms of these young people that get, young girls that get caught up in this world?
I could see how someone can initially think that. And there is a portion of the community that that might be their choice in life, the, you know, older adults. But anyone who's been a parent, of a teen child, you realise that a 16-year-old girl is not an adult and nowhere near able to make those sorts of decisions that bring them to hanging around with these fucking slime balls that, you know, take a kid's youth and really just, like, you know, it's not just a pedophilic sort of thing, it's the demoralising part of it. You know, they might just think it's sex and they might just think it's drug use, but it's for the teen, you know, it's lifelong lasting. If you look at some of the people around this file, you can see what it's probably done to them.
You know, in terms of Melton, I suppose, and this greater area, do you think that this drug culture and this, do you think it's gotten better over the last 28 years or is it getting worse? Or?
The drug has changed, so heroin's not really around as it used to be. And that was a big fight from Victoria Police and I suppose Federal Police as well. But, you know, the underworld sections of Melbourne, you know, they had their great big war in Melbourne and a lot came of that, you know, people died there unnecessarily as well. And, you know, police changed their response to the way they did things. But there's just been this constant, you know, change of the type of drug. And, you know, we've got ICE now and all those sorts of problems. And I think drug use has become, and the impacts of drugs has become something that we deal with now, that we accept it a little too easily, because the ability to fix that is near impossible now. You know, there's, you know, parenting standards have dropped, schooling standards have dropped, in my opinion.
Yeah.
You know, there's that saying that, you know, it takes a village to raise a child. Well, if the village is, you know, not really a place with high ethics, well, you know, you get that, you know, slow degradation. And I think, you know, the drugs have changed. For Victoria Police, I'm sure that their fight is still, you know, a terrible one. But, you know, like, at the end of the day, you are dealing with people. The issue can be frustrating, but you're dealing with people.
Yeah.
And I think you can't say, you know, it's just another drug addict or another this or that. They are people.
For me personally, there's certainly a distinction between adults who make a conscious decision to take drugs and live that life, and those who are young teens, particularly girls, who are led down that path. No 14-year-old has the maturity to make that decision on their own. As I move forward in my investigation and overall understanding of this case, it's become clear that in the eyes of the police, Alana's death was just another tragic youth heroin overdose. In the first two episodes, you've heard a mixture of evidence related to the discovery of Alana's body, details from the autopsy, and you've also heard from Alana's family. In this episode, we are going to hear more of Alana's friends and family, because it's important that you have a complete understanding of Alana's background before we move forward. Because from the next episode onwards, we are going to take things up a notch as I start releasing details of my investigation. And in episode 4, you're going to hear for the first time ever the names of the two men whose DNA was found on Alana. And the truth is going to shock you. But for now, we're going to go back, right back to primary school, and one of Alana's best friends, Leslie Smith, who I meet at her beautiful home just outside of Melbourne.
So, Leslie Smith, and I met Alana, I don't know what grade it was in, but it was primary school. So I did my whole primary years at Coburn Primary in Melton. I cannot remember what year, well, what grade she started, but her dad was a teacher at the school. And we became friends straight away. As soon as she started at the school, we just, you know, hit it off and we were best friends and did everything together. We were inseparable, played netball together with Pacers netball club. We used to go and watch her brother Ricky play football, just to perv on the boys, really, not because we wanted to watch him play football. Yeah, and then, gosh, we just hung out. Like, we're just normal kids.
How would you describe her sort of, I guess, personality and stuff at that point in her life, you know, up until?
Oh, she was just like the life of, so to speak, the party, you know, not that we went to parties or anything, but she was just so happy, so bubbly, smiling all the time. Like, she was just so much fun to be around. She was just beautiful and would do anything for anyone. We used to copy the way each other dressed, so, you know, and she was like the cool kid, so whatever she had, I had to have, and vice versa. So we'd go out and wear the same jeans and these really big oversized jumpers that were, like, I look back now and think, oh my God, that was so ugly. Yeah, but she was just fun, just really fun. She was really good at netball. She was really smart at school. Her dad kept her in line with that because he was a teacher. And he was cool too. Like, everyone just loved him as a teacher but also as her dad. She did start hanging out with Kerry. I think her surname's Woolidge, Kerry Woolidge. And that's when...
Yeah.
Like, we just, I remember she actually said to me, she said, look, I don't want to be your best friend anymore. I'm going to go and be Kerry's best friend. And I was devastated, like, because I just adored her. But I just wasn't part of that scene.
Did you sort of keep tabs from the distance, sort of, and you see what she's up to kind of thing? And
yeah.
You sort of saw that she was going a different...
So although she said that, we didn't talk for a little while, and then it was just like I accepted that she had moved into that group. I had my separate group then. So if we saw each other, we'd say hi and just chat, but we never hung out from that point on. But yes, it was very well known that she had gone off the rails and, was into drugs and all the rest of it. And I just... still to this day, all these years later, like, I just can't believe it because it's not her. Yeah. It's just not her. Like, she was just so happy. I know there's different reasons why people get involved in drugs and all the rest of it, you know, whether it be, you know, they're exposed to it in their upbringing or, you know, something happens. But, I mean, you don't know everything in you know, behind closed doors or whatever, but that just wasn't, like, anything what their family was about. And I knew, like, they would just be mortified and devastated if they knew that she was doing that. But, yeah, it was just wild.
Do you remember when it happened? Or
I know it was the night of the Jarrawarra Festival. I didn't go to that. And I just heard about it. I don't even know, like, how soon after, whether it was the next day or not. I can't remember how soon after it was. It probably would have been because everyone would have been talking about it. Yeah. I just could not believe it. Mm. Could not believe it. I put it down to, like, just that influence is what got her into this mess in the first place. And, you know, how can... If they know something, how can they not? Like, they were kids too. So at the end of the day, like, you can't really hold them accountable for something like this either. Yeah.
If you're a regular listener of this podcast, you'll know I often talk about a vacuum of information in a case. When the public don't have all the details, they'll naturally look to fill that void with answers based on the little they do know. When Leslie was referring to influencers, she was hesitant to say names, but I know she was referring to Alana's best friend, Jodie Hadley. Everyone knew that Jodie and Alana were best friends. Inseparable. Partners in crime together. And when Alana's body was discovered at 211 Station Road, there was one key point about this location that stood out. The vacant house Alana's body was found was only two doors down from a place Alana knew all too well, Jodie Hadley's home. And for many locals and family, this detail just seemed too much of a coincidence. Leslie mentioned a girl, Kerry Warledge, who was friends with Alana after her. I wasn't able to catch up with her in person, but we had a chat on the phone, and she shared some interesting insight into Alana and who she was associating with around that time.
I used to run with her too, so we did athletics together. We were in different, like, clubs. Like, I was for Coburn School. She was for Mountain South at that stage because she went to Mountain South Primary. But Peter was PE teacher at Coburn's as well.
Okay.
He was right into sports. So, yeah, all pretty. Younger, so that was, like, I've known her since I was little. Well, I don't know, maybe about eight, I would say. About 8 years old, I think, 7, 8. Then we went to high school together for a year. Only the first year 7, because after year 7 I left schools and went to a different high school, and she stayed on at the high. So I had left to go to Wilson Park, another school in Melton. And she stayed on at the high school, yeah. But, yeah, like, she was very clever. She was an awesome student and stuff, obviously younger and had her head screwed on back then. Then, unfortunately, she got involved with the wrong people. And to be honest, I don't know what happened to her afterwards. I know she'd been hanging around with some, you know, people on heavy drugs. And after that, I lost contact with her. I didn't hang around with her from there, to be honest, because obviously I wasn't on heavy drugs. And I'd left school. So basically we were in and off a little trouble, like growing up, probably about 13, I think.
Yeah.
We used to sneak out to, obviously teenagers do that, but.
Yeah, I heard.
You guys, I never got on heavy drugs, but I used to drink. We used to drink. And
you were there around a time when she probably started to get a bit rebellious and, you know.
Yeah, we did out. A couple of, we got in trouble. What happened? we snuck out of the houses. We used to go to, like, obviously parties we weren't meant to be at, like blue light discos. They were through school. And we used to go there and drink, and we would say we're staying at someone's house or vice versa to the parents, you know.
Yeah.
And then we just hope they wouldn't check, obviously, the story. Obviously parents do check, so we would always get caught anyway. But we'd snuck out one night. This was funny. We went down to, I don't know why we thought $50 was going to give us a lot, because when you're little, $50 is a lot of money to you, yeah?
Oh, yeah.
Now you can't buy nothing with $50, but back then it was a lot of money. We took $50 off our parents, and we went out drinking. And then we went to a party. We got very drunk, and then we said we're going to run off, and we went to the train station in Melton, actually. We got into big trouble, actually, off Ricky and Peter and my parents. What happened is we were in the toilets at the train station waiting for a train to go to the city, and my mum and Peter, like, they'd obviously started driving around looking for us at this stage. And Mum found us in the toilets at the train station. And how we got caught is because we had our shoes. We used to decorate our shoes at school.
Yeah.
Like with all glitter and stuff, you know, like the Docs. Do you remember those Doc Martin shoes?
Yeah.
We used to love them. And Alana had the one had a red pair and a black pair, you know, and we'd swap and we used to put all glitter on them. And I'd snuck me shoes under the cubicle.
Right.
And my mum recognised the glitter because it had like all the stuff she'd see every day at home after school. And she's like, "No, that's you in there, Kerry." She's banging on the door. And Alana's going to talk. I'm like, "Shh." But it was too late. Well, obviously, we were already caught. So after that, Mum drove us back to Alana's house. And, yeah, we got into big trouble. We got grounded. And, oh, and Ricky was giving us a lecture because Ricky is always, he was the good one, sort of like he, you know, he have his head screwed on all the time, Ricky, basically. Mm. We were a bit, you know, we were a bit bitchy, I think, at that age because 13 to 14 is not a, for girls, it's, yeah, we get a bit bitchy. Yeah. Boys are a bit more chilled and relaxed, aren't they? A bit more easygoing, I suppose.
So how old would you have been then, like 12, 13 or something?
Yeah, 13. Yeah, we were 13 then. And then I got grounded for a week. Alana got grounded for a week, but it never lasts. I think we were out like maybe a few days later, but after, you know, probably moping around the house. And then not long after that, to be honest, then not long after that, my mum said, "That's it. You've changed in schools." My mum, it was my mum, yeah, she put it, she said, "You're getting out of that school, you're hanging around with idiots, blah, 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 this and that, and you're too much trouble. It's either that or you go to a boarding school. So which one do you want to do?" And I was like, "Oh, well, obviously that's not really a great choice, so I suppose I'll just swap high schools." And then after that, basically Jodie was with, this is how it happened. They got with the brothers. Do you know the
Cowards?
Yeah. So Jodie got was with Chris, and Alana was with Mark.
Yeah.
And then after that, to be honest, once they started getting involved with them, and I knew of them. Like, I mean, they lived because my mum, where I grew up, she'd like there were the next two streets down from us. So, you know, like every time I go, I knew they weren't good people. And I've got an older brother, Ricky's age, like So my brother's a year older than Ricky, my brother is, and he'd already knew of them too and said, you know, like, if you go there, basically, like, I'll basically come and blow the house up. Basically, it was like that sort of thing, you know. So I had stopped, associating with them then. And Alana and Jodie, like, they had changed, from that stage. Anyhow, they're totally different people. She just turned into a totally different person. And when you're a girl younger, like, it's cruel because you think back, it's like a cool thing, isn't it? Like the guy's older than you, because Mark was, I don't know exactly how many years older he was, but a few up from us. And, you know, she'd obviously he's, he took down the wrong path and it went from there. That's the true story. Yeah. Then I don't know who she met through him, but obviously they were drug addicts and and that's where it, I suppose it went all downhill from there, didn't it? And then I remember the night of the bonfire. Do you remember that one? I went to the bonfire, but I didn't obviously see Alana because I had a couple of girlfriends from my other school. But they were totally like different. Like they weren't on, you know what I mean, heavy drugs or anything. So we had a couple of drinks and I didn't see her. But then I remember the police like finding out the next morning. Obviously what had happened. It was a big shock. I felt sick for so long. And then I think I sort of felt a bit bad because I wasn't talking to her and, you know, you know, as you do when someone dies, it's not like it's my fault. But, I mean, you still feel like I, you know.
When you're that young too.
Sort of seen it coming, but not to that extent. Does that make sense? Like I sort of knew when she was involved with them, she was, you know, turned into a different person. You can't really tell someone what to do either, can you? They've got to want to change by themselves.
Alana clearly had a rebellious streak. She was a confident young teen pushing her boundaries. But we could argue that up until this point, her exploits remained innocent enough. However, there seems to have been a shift when Alana, aged 13, found a new boyfriend and an older boy, Mark Coward, and was exposed to harder drugs. It's at around this age of 14 that things start to get blurry. But in the upcoming episodes, we're going to speak to people who will be able to give us a much clearer picture of this time. But for now, we're going to hear from someone who played an important role in Alana's life, and will be able to add to this timeline of her final years, months, and weeks. Her aunt, a qualified nurse, and Peter's sister, Irene Cecil.
My name's Irene Cecil. I'm Alana's aunt, and I was there at her birth, and have been pretty close with Alana for a very, well, since she actually tragically died. So,
And you're a nurse as well.
I am a nurse, and I was at the hospital she was born at, in the theatre. She was a caesarean section, and I saw her first and foremost in her sex, and I went out and told my brother, because Mum was under a general anaesthetic. And I said to Peter, "You've got a little girl, and I've got a little niece." And then he was able to came out with the baby, because we used to bring the babies out when Mum's asleep and take them out to Dad. And then so Peter was the first one that would have been holding Alana before Mum, which is because she's in anaesthetic and in recovery room. So I went in and saw Cheryl in the recovery and told her, and she goes, "No, don't let anyone see me without my dad." I said, "They're back." It was so funny. And I said, "You got a little girl." She goes, "Oh," and she's so excited and a bit drowsy and groggy. But Peter was already out there with Alana then and the baby. So it was a really exciting time for me. And that's the first time I'd been present at any of, not Ricky's, but definitely I was at Alana's.
Yeah.
Because it was at where I was working.
In any case, everyone always presents a different angle to the story. And Irene has her own. She remembers a beautiful, cheeky young girl who she believes got in with the wrong crowd and then struggled to deal with the breakup of her parents around the same time. On one occasion, after a particularly heated exchange at home, Alana had run off and called Irene, who lived in Airport West, a 30-minute drive away, from a payphone in the middle of the night.
If you go down Mickleham and go down, and there's probably about 10, not even 10K, 8K if you're lucky. She made her way out there.
Just like that, in the middle of the night?
Well, I reckon it was got to be 10, 11 o'clock at night.
Yeah, that's for a 14-year-old, that's just...
She knew how to get there. So that tells me... But I was shocked she rang me the Airport West car park in the shop, and it was a shopping centre. So she obviously has got the public transporter, hopped on a tram or got a lift or hitchhiked. I don't know.
Yeah.
So she got there and we stayed home, and I said, "Don't worry, they're not going to come here." It's Peter, and I said, "Your mum, Christine and Peter aren't even going to think, yeah. And if they come to the door, you'll be fine. Just zip off." Anyway, so our main thing was to protect her there, and plus make sure no legal, no more policey, whatever, because I thought that's the last thing you need. And I wasn't sure how angry everything was going on, so I didn't tell anyone she was there either. I said, "Look, just keep her quiet, lay low, and I'll break the ice a bit in a day or two, see what's going on." Right. So I left it there. She was great. Didn't nick off, didn't disappear. She's just in hiding zone. We sort of had, I think it was coffees, and and that's when she'd tell me how great she was, so rapt in the cheeky face. I'm sorry, Alana can't laugh. Because it was just that cheeky little grin. And I went, "Now here." I said, "Let's play some music." So we put on her favourite music and everything, and we were just blasting some music and everything. Not blasting, but the kids were sleeping in that. But she said, "Oh, that's one of my favourites." And she put them on, and we do that. So that was kind of the night to just, let's get rid of this and let's go to fun forward. You know, let's not think about it and whatever. So anyway, the couple of days went, and then I gave my brother a ring to see how everything's going.
Those experienced with drug addiction will understand that aside from the damage the drug itself does, there are many other struggles that come with dependency. During this time, as Alana was progressively hanging out with a rougher crowd, she started acting out in other ways that were unlike her, like shoplifting. and these indiscretions were catching up with the 15-year-old, who was at this time addicted to heroin. And this came to a head when, if it weren't for Irene's quick thinking, Alana was set to be sent to juvenile detention.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems. But getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
So then she fronted the court with the other incident. So what we did then, Peter said, could I come to the court support and everything? And then I heard the judge turn around. At the time, was sitting back in the seat and Peter was there, and the judge just turned around and said to her, well, he said, I think really you need to go for a stint in the, he called it jail, but it was, it would be juvie, into jail and whatever he's going. I think that's the only pathway for you. And I sort of said, I don't know if they're going to take any notice of this, but I just said, look, you know, is it okay if I could speak? And he said, yes, you know, and I said, state your name. And I said, look, Irene Cecil, I'm a nurse, I'm Alana's niece. And I wondered if it's okay if I could put something forward, that is it okay if Alana could come and stay with myself and my children and myself away from Melton area? And maybe we can look at a program to help her sort of with some of the problems. I didn't want to say too much like that, but he knew exactly what I'm talking about. Yes. And he said, in that way we can give her a chance. And he said, right, there was something that was straight up. So he's contemplating. And then he looked at her, at Delana, and then looked at me, and he said, this is your own, this could possibly be your only chance, and yes, I'd be happy with that outcome. And yeah, and he said, but know this, this is your last chance to me. If you come back to my court, he said, consider yourself going in, don't bother with anything else, you'll be going straight to jail. So he, like, cut and dry. And I went, oh, he means business. That's what it's for. Thinking. So that was the last effort to sort of get her away. My idea was to get her away from Melton and let's start her on a program. Let's see if she, and she was happy with that, but we had boundaries. We had, before I did that with Alana, I said, I've got to have some rules in place. We don't do any lying and deceit. And I said, One of my rules in the house with the kids and everything, we don't lie, if possible. But it was more about sneaking out and going. You know, I wasn't 100% sure.
If you're going to do something, like, let me know what you're.
And even if you've done it, yeah, give me the heads up, so yeah, I'm ready in case there's any problems. Right? Alana was very strong-minded, but she was also fantastic when she came and lived with me.
Yeah, let's go
she
back to that.
Did the methadone program? Yeah. She continued to do that. She was gorgeous, but she vomited in a bucket lots of times, and the kids, little ones, I think they're about 3 or 4, would be patting her on the back saying, it's okay, it's okay. So they were really sort of trying to soothe her. She loved them. She took them for walks up the street daily to get an ice cream, and they'd come back telling us all about what they'd seen. I didn't think the butcher was a good idea, but just to say, Well, you're going to have to learn about them. Neat. So anyway, they did that daily because I'd be working as well. And, of course, Damien had come home. He was, I think, at that stage about 14. He was about a year younger than Alana. So that was all good, and we all worked beautifully together. And Alana would help around the house. Like, she was doing me a favour, and I trusted her so much with the kids that she would be really doting and loving. So it was really lovely to see all that. So we had a lovely time, and we had her room was still got a lot of messiness. So we thought, let's make it beautiful. Like the kids said, let's make it beautiful. So anyway, what had happened was the Cheryl's mother wanted to take her to Queensland for a holiday. She was going on a holiday, and I think, as you know, Cheryl's sister lives up in Queensland, and so she wanted to go up, and Ricky was still down here. She wasn't there then. And can I take Alana on a holiday? And I thought, well, it's up to Alana if she wants to go. But I explained I'm going to have to transfer the methadone program up to where you're staying, and I think it was only going to be a week. So we organised that. The transfer was done. She was going back. So while she was away, the girls and I decided that we're going to sparkle up her room and make it nice. We cleaned it all up and made all this pretty and everything. Anyway, she was due back, and she never came. She never came back.
Alana never did go back to Irene's. Some days later, Irene discovered that Alana had returned home to her mum's in Melton, which, given what she was going through, is very understandable. But for Irene, it came with grave concern. The whole point of staying with me, she says, was to get her out of Melton and away from those people that were the source of her drug problems. But despite her concerns, Irene says that when she did speak to Alana a few weeks later, she could tell that Alana was well. She obviously wasn't using and appeared to be on a good track.
I took some, it would have been 2 weeks or 3 weeks prior, and I took some of the belongings back. So that's what I was saying. I gave her a little bit of space for a little while, but it would have been only a month or two in that, but I wanted to get her belongings back. And I took them to Peter and Christine's. And she was at the car, came out, and she was helping. And she was fine. She didn't look drugged. She wasn't speaking drug affected.
Yeah.
To me, she looked... There was no way she was drug affected. She was speaking fine, but what the concern for me was, and I sort of was making her feel, wanted to make her feel really good. I said, the kids love you, and because she turned around and says, I'm going off to meet some friends. And I thought, right, my number one thing was, oh, no, not the clan, you know. And I said, are you going to be okay? And I said, have you been doing anything? Yeah. And she goes, no. No.
And so when was this?
This was probably about 2 to 3 weeks prior to it happening.
Cool, yeah.
And I said, well done. You know, it sounded to me like she was doing really okay.
Yeah.
And that's why when you're saying that, I agree. Mm. And I think I might have wrote that. It didn't look to me like any indicator, but I just had this terrible feeling when she said she's meeting up with people that there's something not, I'm not real,
yes.
Bad gut feeling. Yeah. Bad gut feeling. Anyway, I said, now you be careful, all right? You be really careful. And I think that's probably what happened. Just a terrible gut feeling. I said, be really careful. And I said, and you have, you know, a lovely day and everything because we, oh, that's right, we went inside.
Was this the last time you spoke to her?
Last time we saw it. And I just went into her room when I was carrying her things in and we were talking and chatting. So we were getting on fine. There was no worries, and she was good. She goes, I've got a real favourite song, Irene. You want to hear it? And so I said, yeah. Absolutely. She played Lightning Crashes, and I went, oh, I love that song too, because it's all about birth and death. And she goes, I so love it. And she goes, I said, that's a beautiful song. She was so into it, and she's saying, she's just feeling, and she was not numb, she was fine. And then I said to her, I said, look, you know, if you ever want any music and that, you know, I've got stacks. I said, you could have any of it. And she goes, oh. I said, I know, probably old-fashioned. Yeah. So we'd have laughs and jokes, and then we went. I took the girls, and it was probably about half an hour, and then I spoke to Pete and whatever, and then nicked off. That was the last time I saw Alana alive. So, and that was probably about 2.5-3 weeks. I rang my parents when I got back. Terrible gut feeling. I just said, look, Dad, Mum. Just, or Robin, just be really careful. I just have this terrible feeling something might happen, and I wouldn't be shocked if something happened to Alana. And that was just uncanny that I'd even act upon it. even tell them, for starters, but I just had this terrible feeling something's not right. Whether she's not telling me everything that was happening with, and when you, the scenario with the caravan, I don't know how long before that happened, but...
The truth is, Alana wasn't telling her everything. Irene mentioned a caravan scenario. We won't go into details of this just yet. But needless to say, there were serious events unfolding in Alana's life that were potentially much more dangerous than a possible drug relapse. Call it woman's intuition or a sixth sense. But Irene sensed something this day. The last day she saw Alana alive. And then a few weeks later, that terrible gut feeling was realized when Irene got the call from Christine that Alana was dead.
At home, in the shower, got a phone call from Christine. And I said, what's happened? This was like, I'm in the shower, sort of got out of the shower, pretty wet. And she goes, and I sort of, she said, Alana, something's happened to Alana. And I just like, just knew it, just this thing in my head said, I knew it, right? And she said, is she okay? And she goes, no, she's dead. And I went, okay. I said, where's Peter? I thought, this is going to be a killer. And I said, is Peter there? And she goes, he's too distraught. And I'm just ringing. I thought, oh, I'll tell him I'm on my way. Right. So just straight on with clothes. Got the kid, children looked after. With Chris, I rang up, said, look, can you just take the kids? Something's happened to the lake. Yeah. And so I went up. Peter's and Christine's. He was just numb.
As a father now myself, I can only imagine the pain Peter and his family were going through at this time. Peter himself told me, it's like living a nightmare. For Irene, the pain was mixed. On one hand, the terrible reality of what had happened, and on the other, that nagging feeling she knew something wasn't right. As a nurse, it was decided Irene would be the one to identify Alana's body. Given her experience, she would likely be able to emotionally handle the situation best. She told me that as she walked into the room, she still held on to that hope that maybe there was a mistake and that it wasn't Alana. And for a fleeting moment, she actually thought it wasn't. Until she realized there was no doubt. As she stood there alone in that room, looking at Alana through the glass, she spoke to her, as if almost trying to reach out through the window and through time.
It was like, I think I said, I can't believe it. I just thought, I can't believe this. That's what I believe. I think I said it to her. Said like, it was like this. Alana, I think I said, I can't believe it. And that was probably it. It was like this terrible feeling that, yeah, it's her. Made me feel a bit sick. It's hard to remember all the real stuff. I think what was vivid was watching and looking at her, saying just, I can't believe that, or can't believe it. That was probably what I think I was saying. It was like this terrible realization, but I sort of wasn't surprised. I think when I was walking, I even thought to myself, I just knew it. Anyway, I went out and signed the document that you have to sign to say you've done the identification and tick. I think you have to tick worthy if I did. And went out to Peter and I just sort of said, I just sort of went, yep, it's Alana.
In any case of a tragic death, particularly of a young person, the ripples are far-reaching and long-lasting. To finish up this third episode, we're going to hear from another of Alana's family, a woman who was only 6 years old at the time of Alana's death, but who still has fond memories. Irene's daughter, Sammy.
So I'm Samantha Dargan, and Alana, Cecil, is my cousin.
Yeah.
my first cousin. And when she died, I was about 6 years old. I'd just turned six. And she was amazing, to be honest. From what I remembered, she was very cheeky. She loved babysitting me and my sister. Loved, like, she became a kid herself whenever she'd be around us. She taught me and my sister, you know, what an innie and an outie belly button was. And we didn't understand what that meant at the time, but she would, like, compare our belly buttons and we'd have a bit of fun. You know, I've got fond memories of my mum cooking in the kitchen, and, you know, Alana had stayed with us for I'm not sure if it was a short or long period of time, but she was there in Airport West for a while. And I remembered it was just to get away from a bad crowd. And she kind of made that very clear as well. She loved hanging out with us. She'd pinch coins from the coin jar that my mum would have above the fridge on top of it. And, you know, she'd show us what the gold ones were compared to the silver. And we would be like, oh, wow, we'd think we'd be rich. But she was really sweet. She would, you know, always be telling me as the older sister to look after my little sister. She was, you know, very charismatic, very fun. She taught us what a Buffalo Bill was. That was her favorite ice cream. So we actually got introduced to that ice cream from her. She taught us how to blow, bubbles with the chewing gum, and she'd teach us all the kind of fun things when we were little. I do remember some memories with her. The hardest thing for me is that I never really got to bond with her. She bonded with me, but I never got the chance to bond with her.
And tell me, so you recently found something with your mum?
Yes. It's not recent. Like, I guess this is something that I found years back. It was when we were living in Airport West, and I've kept it all these years, but it's a Lana's watch, and I have it with me in my room all the time. But my mum and me, I guess my mum was sorting through some things like jewelry and bits and pieces when we're moving, and she goes, oh, Alana would have wanted you to have this. And it came in this little wooden box that's never been moved out of it. And yeah, sure enough, I was in awe that it was Alana's watch to begin with, because I was like, wow, she had good taste, you know. And then I was looking at it and I'm like, mum, what's that on the back, you know? And she goes, oh, and we put it up to the sunlight, and it was like, to Sam, love, like spelt L-U-V. Like Alana would have, Love Alana, 1996. So Alana got this engraved in preparation to give to me at some point. I don't know if it was maybe one of my birthday milestones coming up at the time, I'm not sure, but she had this kept away, and yeah, my mum's had it safe ever since, and I just think it's so beautiful.
When I'm investigating a case, I have a responsibility to tell that person's story. In Alana's case, it's the tragic death of a 16-year-old girl who became addicted to heroin at 14 and died of an overdose. Well, that's the story the Melton police will tell you. But my job is to give you context. Alana was a free spirit. She was intelligent, cheeky, and mischievous. She was also incredibly generous, caring, and loyal to a fault. She was a teenage girl going through the difficulties of her parents separating, and while we have to consider that, yes, she made some bad choices, these choices were made within the context of those she had chosen to call her friends at the time of her death. And yet, despite this short but difficult road she'd travelled in her last 18 months, we have to give her credit where it's due. She had made the decision to turn her life around. She had that whole life ahead of her. Until that one fateful night, the night of the bonfire. So what happened? Did Alana attend the bonfire? Who was with her? And what trouble was Alana really in? These are all questions that I'm going to be pursuing and answering in upcoming episodes of Guilt. And I'll tell you now, strap in, because this is going to be a wild ride. And it begins in the next episode, when I release, for the first time ever, the names of the two men whose semen was found on and inside Alana. And this case changes forever.
Dear Melanie and everyone else, sorry my letter is so late. Thanks for my lovely birthday present. I'm wearing my earrings now. I loved my NWA t-shirt. I was so surprised. I thought Mom told you to get it, but she didn't. I love my headband and my bum bag. You shouldn't have gotten all that stuff. I bet it cost you a fortune. All that stuff is in fashion down here. This is my second week of school holidays. The first week of the holidays, we all went to Nana's. I wanted $150 for Nike runners. I had the $50, but Mum or Dad wouldn't give me the $50, so I got some Nikes for $110. I still got my Reebok pumps. They're not ranked, and I still wear them heaps. On last Saturday, I went to the grand final to see the Eagles vs Hawks. Of course, the mighty brilliant Hawks won. I hate the Eagles. Congratulations, boys. You won your footy. Melanie, are you still playing netball? Dad and I arrived to the grand final at about 8:30 a.m. We were there for all the games. Anyways, that's enough about sport. I can't wait to come up and see you. Love, Alana. 13th September 1991.
Guilt is a Brevity Studios production. Written, produced, and narrated by me, Ryan Wolfe. All opinions expressed in this podcast are exactly that, opinions, and are not a statement of fact by the podcast itself. All persons named are presumed innocent unless proven otherwise in a court of law. You'll find further photos, videos, and daily updates on my Instagram, RyanWolfNZ. If you would like to visit Alana, her family kindly welcomes you. She can be found in Melton Cemetery, under the gum tree, off the Cadros Ave entrance. And of course, make sure you take a moment to look up in the tree for the owl. The fantastic original score was produced specifically for this season of Guilt by Sam Morgan at sunroomsound.com. If you're looking for original music for your project, check out his great work. Our new and improved website, theguiltpodcast.com, was designed by Jacob at Medio Street Media. If you're looking for any help with web, brand design, or digital marketing, you'll find them at mediostreetmedia.com. Guilt is a 100% independent production. We've never received a single dollar in taxpayer funding. You can support us to continue to make great content, plus get ad-free listening, bonus episodes, and early release by becoming a Brevity Plus subscriber on Apple or Acast Plus. You'll find the details on how to subscribe at www.theguiltpodcast.com. This podcast was written and edited without the use of AI.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue checkmark next to that thing you love. And be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit eBay.com for terms.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.